This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. And for all our new listeners this week, thank you so much for listening. We've been welcoming listeners from Philadelphia, listening on WHYY, to Minnesota Public Radio, KQED in San Francisco, and listeners in Hawaii and San Antonio, on WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Shreveport, Louisiana. No matter where you are, thanks so much for listening. We hope you had a great 4th of July holiday. We begin this hour with the continuing turmoil in Egypt following the ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Following days of popular protest, the Egyptian military deposed Morsi on Wednesday and installed an interim civilian leader, the head of Egypt's constitutional court. Now, Morsi and many of his top aides are now under house arrest, and at least 300 members of the Muslim Brotherhood have been arrested. Today, the Brotherhood and its supporters are staging demonstrations all across the country. It is Friday, prayer day, after all. They're doing that in protest of what they're calling a military coup, and that term could have serious consequences for U.S.-Egyptian relations. The United States is required by law to cut off non-humanitarian aid to Egypt in the event of a coup, so the word matters. Joining us now is Mona Makram Abaid, who resigned on Saturday as a member of the parliament in Egypt. She's also a political science professor at the American University in Cairo. Mona, welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us. Why resign your seat in parliament?
This was in support of the protesters, the youth protesters, who have started an extremely creative movement called Tamarrud, which means rebel. We were all behind them, and we thought, you know, that there was no place for us anymore in a parliament that is a lame duck, after all.
As an elected official, however, even though you've resigned, it must give you pause that other elected officials, Mohamed Morsi, the president, members of the Muslim Brotherhood, were elected after all, and after only a year, have now been deposed.
You know, the ballot box is just a mechanism of democracy, but it is not particularly democracy. Now, this was a popular movement in Egypt for democratic change that resists dictation from anyone or autocracy in the name of religion. So I believe that if the army had not intervened to restore order, we would have seen a bloodbath, and we would have seen, and Mr. Morsi would have been one of the targets of the bloodbath. So I think this came also in his favor, what happened.
Well, going forward, Mona Makram Abaid, there must be concern about inclusion of the Muslim Brotherhood. There have been arrests, of course. Mohamed Morsi remains under house arrest, and hundreds of his colleagues. How important is it going forward to make sure that the Muslim Brotherhood and their millions of supporters are included in the process and not marginalized?
Absolutely. We do not want to repeat the blunders that the Muslim Brotherhood has made by being extremely exclusive, by ostracizing everyone that was not, you know, one of their supporters, by putting them in prison, by preventing them even to express their opinion, and so on. So I believe that the Muslim Brothers must be included as a political faction and not as a religious missionaries. We don't need clerics to impose on us what they want. But as a political party, they have all the right to be in the political scene. They should be included and then compete and let the best man win.
Unrestricted, in other words, if a different Muslim Brotherhood representative or indeed Mr. Morsi himself can win the next election, that's fine with you?
If he wins through the ballot box, yes, it is. I doubt it very much. Look, Mr. Morsi is a past president. He has been refused by the whole people of Egypt, but three-quarters of the people. As you can see, the mass demonstrations were the biggest in the history of Egypt.
There is concern at the same time that some hard lessons are being learned by some of the more radical members of the Muslim Brotherhood after decades of repression under the Mubarak regime and even before, dating back to Nasser, not being able to participate, finally participating in democracy, having that unravel for whatever reason, that the lesson for many of these people might be that violence is the only way to further their goals, not the ballot box in the first place.
Look, first of all, yes, they've been harassed, but they have had relations with every government, every system, whether it was Nasser until he put them out, whether it was Sadat until they killed him, whether it was Mubarak, and so on. So, I mean, they were not out of the picture. They were in prison, yes. They spent a lot of time in prison. They were probably very badly treated, ill-treated. But when they came to power, they wanted to dominate, not to participate. They wanted to dominate the whole scene. They wanted to project their own Islamic project, which is refused by everybody else or by the majority of the people, the majority of the people who are literate, who do not want the spirit of Egypt to change. We want a democratic, civilian, modern, secular Egypt. We do not want to have religion imposed on us. We do not want to have the clerics to have the upper hand. The army today is here to restore order. It is not a coup. It is according to the demands of the people who have asked them to come.
Mona Makram Abaid, you make the point that it's not a coup, as you No, I'm sure there's a debate now going on in this country about whether to call it a coup or not, and there are billions of dollars at stake. What does it mean for Egyptian stability to you if political pressure in the United States leads to a reduction in military or foreign aid? Because people are talking about that.
Look, the main pivots of Egyptian-U.S. relations are the military relations between both countries, who have survived for more than 50 years now. I don't think that it's the time today to jeopardize that, and particularly when what is happening in Egypt is a popular revolution. Since we are celebrating Independence Day, you should see what Thomas Jefferson, the hero of democracy, always said. Every generation needs a new revolution, and experience has shown that even under the best forms of government, those entrusted with power have in time and by slow operations perverted it into tyranny. So the spirit of resistance to government is valuable on certain occasions, and I wish it to be always alive. I'm quoting Thomas Jefferson, and I think that the United States should analyze very carefully what is happening today in Egypt and realize that it is the majority that spoke. It is the people of Egypt who have spoken, not the army.
Mona Makram Abaid is a former member of parliament who resigned just on Saturday and a political science professor at the American University in Cairo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as you just heard, Mona Makram Abaid says what's happening in Egypt is a popular revolution, not a coup. But the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't see it that way. And as generals forcibly removed Mohamed Morsi from power earlier this week, many Islamists see the Egyptians' military's actions as a coup. And the Brotherhood's loss of power could also have profound implication for political Islamists throughout the world. Joining us again, Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. Welcome back, Shadi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have an editorial in the pages of today's New York Times, which speaks to both of these issues, and I want to deal with them in turn. And let's deal with the first one. You have lots of warnings. Given the history of repression of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist movements in countries throughout the Middle East, urging a lot of caution about how the Muslim Brotherhood is treated now that they're out of power.
Exactly. You know, watching what's going on now, I feel like we're repeating history and not learning from past lessons. When you exclude people and block them from the democratic process, they're going to consider other means outside of the political system. That's dangerous because they might consider violence. And if we look at previous historical episodes, after the Brotherhood was brutally repressed in the 1950s and 60s, there were breakaway factions from the Brotherhood that became militant and even resorted to terrorism. And that's eventually how we got to Al-Qaeda and other groups of that ilk. Authoritarianism can have a radicalizing effect. And then we see Algeria in 1992, where again, Islamists were oppressed, but this time it was a little bit different. The main Islamist party there was on the brink of winning the elections. And before it could take office, the Algerian military stepped in and blocked that. And what happened is you saw Islamists in Algeria resorting to armed struggle against the regime. I hope that doesn't happen in Egypt. And it's still too early to tell which way it'll go. But if we insist on excluding Islamist groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood, from the political process, then we have to worry about the consequences. They might not be obvious right away, but there could be real consequences over the long term. And it's also worth noting that there's already reports of militants taking action against military checkpoints and a local airport in the Sinai area. So maybe we are seeing a very quick reaction.
Yes.
We don't know if that's in direct response to the coup of the other day, but there's already signs that some Islamists are moving in that direction.
Near the Gaza border, we've seen those reports. Well, before we let you go, Shadi Hamid, the other issue that you speak to, you heard Mona Makram Abaid say that U.S. aid to the military to the tune of $1.5 billion, she implied it promotes stability. Now is not the time to shake things up with the backing of the military in Egypt. You write that the United States needs to reconsider its aid to the military because we're promoting a system that's not working.
Yeah, Mona Makram Abaid is wrong on basic factual things. There is no debate about whether or not this was a coup. By any definition of the word, it was a coup. Not only that, it was a textbook coup. It couldn't be any more coup-like than it was. So I understand that some Egyptians are sensitive to that word because it has a negative connotation, but words matter, and we have to call things by what they are. So based on that, legally, the U.S. is obligated, it's not even a choice, is obligated to suspend aid until democratic elections are held.
But you and I both know that the U.S. is going to do what's in its interest here, and you're arguing that it may be in the U.S. interest to reconsider this money.
Well, I think it's important to use the lever of military aid to try to put pressure on the new regime in Egypt to bring Islamists back into the political process. That's the really crucial thing. And we're already seeing signs of a crackdown. As you mentioned earlier, at least 300 Muslim Brotherhood members are arrested or being in the process of being arrested. So that is, we're already seeing some very concerning indications. And I thought it was interesting when you asked Makram Abaid, what if Morsi or another Brotherhood leader wants to run for elections or even president? And she seemed, not very enthusiastic about that. And the question is, will the Brotherhood be allowed to compete on an equal footing, or will they be prevented again?
And the Obama administration reportedly is reviewing military aid to Egypt. We don't know exactly what that review means, but we will be watching it, and so will Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. Read his op-ed in the pages of the New York Times today. Shadi, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
With Egypt in turmoil and the country heavily divided, the stability of the Middle East is yet again being thrown into question. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has called the Muslim Brotherhood's ouster the fall of political Islam and has tried to use the Brotherhood's failure in Egypt to bolster support for his regime. The rebels are left in a difficult position as their coalition against Assad includes the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, and some have accused the Brotherhood there of monopolizing power in the rebel ranks. But the true picture of the rebels has been hard to come by, and as the Syrian conflict rages into its third year with over 100,000 dead, reporters are finding it difficult to obtain accurate information, and some media outlets don't seem to be trying very hard. Patrick Coburn is Middle East correspondent for The Independent. He's just returned from Syria, and he views almost all reports of that country with a skeptical eye. He argues that the one-sided reporting from the foreign media, driven by rebels, is ruling out serious negotiations and influencing Western policymakers in a negative way.
I've never known a conflict like this, that so much of the information is not just second-hand, but third or fourth-hand. So much of it comes from opposition activists who have an obvious and understandable bias. So I think that the picture that the outside world has is really disconnected from the reality there.
Now, is this just a function of poor reporting or more a function of the fact that in war, both sides will use propaganda to their advantage? And in fact, there isn't really a good news line into the Syrian government because they're so secretive. We only hear from one side.
Yeah, those are both elements that come into it. One could also say, you know, they limit the access of journalists, of giving visas to journalists to cover the government side, and therefore you have a vacuum of information about something that everybody's interested in, and this vacuum tends to be filled with pretty suspect information. You know, I've sort of said to Syrian officials that really, you know, they may complain a lot about what is said about them, but the way to deal with this is have actual eyewitnesses there. And there isn't really, I mean, any replacement for eyewitnesses for reporting any facts, particularly during a war. So I think that overall the reporting, yeah, has been pretty bad.
All right. Well, you say that we have a perception, and we certainly do, that the rebel forces are white hats, Assad forces are black hats, and that sort of guides all the reporting. But what is it then about the Syrian conflict that we think we know, that you have seen, that has us under misapprehensions about what's really going on there?
Well, I think a whole number of things. One, it's a genuine civil war. However it started with popular demonstrations, at this stage, you have a core of support for the opposition and you have a core of support for the government. You have many Syrians who don't like both. You have many Syrians who don't much like the government, but really don't see that the opposition are putting forward any alternative government that they'd like to live under. So I think a supposition, which you get from government leaders, from Susan Rice, from David Cameron, and other international leaders, that there's a police state government on one side with a tiny group of fanatical supporters, on the other side a great popular movement supported by all Syrians, is just completely contrary to the facts. I think also a supposition until recently that the Bashar al-Assad government was going to go down quite easily. On the contrary, I think that there's a stalemate, that this war could go on for a very long time. But could I go back to an earlier point about the way it's reported here from outside the country with secondhand sources? I mean, it's rather as if, you know, British reporters like me had tried to report the last American presidential election based on in Canada and occasionally going into the United States with maybe members of the Republican Party, Tea Party, to be taken round on tours. And we just drew our sources from our information from one side, the Republican side, in the presidential election. That's really the analogy with what we're getting in Syria. You know, one would end up with a wholly ludicrous conception of what's happening in the United States, and one's getting a pretty skewed idea of what's happening in Syria.
Are we missing, then, Patrick Coburn, essential facts about who the rebel forces are? We've heard, of course, that it's a mixture of secular forces, Islamist forces, some affiliated with al-Qaeda, but not all. You say that people can sort of switch back and forth between those ideologies and that we don't really understand whose side we're on there.
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, you see conferences. We just had a conference in Qatar of the so-called 11 friends of Syria, including the United States and Britain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. And this, they're going to support the Free Syrian Army. But actually, inside Syria, the Free Syrian Army doesn't exist as an institution. There isn't a command and control system. You basically have fragmented brigades, maybe 1,000 of them, all spread all over Syria. So I think it's very sort of misleading to think there's one opposition military institution that we can give weapons and support to, and somehow that's going to win and replace the government. That just isn't the situation. And I don't think that reporting has really reflected or explained this.
Well, before we let you go, Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent, is there a way out of this with the Assad regime relying on secrecy as they do, with the West having only a limited understanding of the many factions that comprise what we call the Free Syrian Army? Is there a way out of the information smog that we have other than, you know, the few reporters who go on the ground like yourself?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that would help if the Syrian government would let in more people, but I think that also that news organizations need to be much more careful than they've been of sieving first-hand unbiased information from third or fourth-hand extremely biased information. I think that people have been very credulous in just accepting what they're told from somebody outside Syria, from somebody inside Syria who's heard it from somebody else. This isn't really the way that news should work.
Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent, says Western organizations, news organizations, are relying on second and third-hand information, but worse, that policymakers relying on that information are making very limited and misguided decisions in Syria. Patrick Coburn with The Independent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, days after 19 firefighters were killed in a massive wildfire in Arizona, details are now emerging about how the Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot crew were overtaken by flames and the conditions that rapidly changed and led to their deaths. Cindy Carcamo is national correspondent for the LA Times based in Arizona. She and her colleagues got an exclusive on the first detailed explanation of what happened on Sunday. Hi, Cindy.
Hello.
Cindy Carcamo, it all went down at a housing complex called Glen Isla. What do we know about what happened?
Yes. Well, basically, these hotshot crews were on a ridge. They were performing what's called a backburn. So what they were doing was they were setting kind of like a line, a break on fire to clear a path between the community of Glen Isla and the fire that was approaching. And what happened was sometime between 3 to 4:30, the winds shifted. It was described to me as some kind of inversion. So what happens is all of the wind from this thunderstorm cell that was approaching just gathered together and went down on the firefighters, and it was taking a lot of this smoke with it, a lot of the black smoke with it. So it created this situation where the firefighters had zero visibility, and it basically made the fire encircle them. So they were trapped, and they're supposed to have a safe zone and an escape route to be able to get out in situations like that. But the fire just completely encircled them. So when they were trying to get to their escape route, they were met with a wall of flames.
Is there any indication, Cindy Carcamo, that preparations weren't what they should be? Of course, these situations are completely unpredictable, or can be. They do have safety procedures with lookouts and such, as we understand it. Is there any indication that normal procedures weren't followed, or was it just a case of very dangerous work and tragic conditions?
There's no indication of that so far. And again, they're still investigating the fire. But it appears right now that they did what they could to prepare for the fire. But the situation was so bad, the weather turned so quickly, within minutes, that the escape route that they had prepared, basically they couldn't get to it.
And your article in the LA Times, Cindy Carcamo, says that the firefighters were found all huddled together in one place.
Yes. Yes, it appears that they had only minutes to be able to create their like a little safe zone. And it appears that it might not have been big enough, perhaps, because they just didn't have time to break down all the brush to be able to get to that topsoil so they could be safe. So they did what they could, and they just huddled together underneath their fire shelters. It's a horrible situation.
Cindy, do we know what happened with the 20th man on the crew, the one who survived?
Yes, the lone survivor was a lookout for the crew. So he spotted the wind shift, and he saw that things were getting out of control. So what he did was he radioed in, let them know that he was going to be getting out of that situation, and advised them to do the same. He went back to get to the buggy that they have, the hotshot crews, they have these buggies. And so he went back to do that. He looked back and he saw that the flames had moved so dramatically. And basically, you know, his colleagues had been overrun. Every indication is that he did his job. He did what he was supposed to do, or did what protocol requires of. So he was able to survive, but it was because he was in a different area and he was the lookout.
It is a terrible, terrible situation. Cindy Carcamo of the LA Times has the first exclusive detailing what appears to have gone wrong with the Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot crew outside of Yarnell, Arizona, that led to the death of 19 firefighters. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
To Northern California now, where after a four-day strike, Bay Area Rapid Transit workers returned to work today. Although union management negotiations are far from over, it's known as BART, the system there. The Bay Area train system shuttles over 400,000 riders every day, and the strike left many scrambling for transportation alternatives. Dan Brecky, news editor for KQED Public Media, was one of those riders left stranded, and he joins me now from San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
Classic transit strike, pay and pensions in a contract negotiation. What are we dealing with here?
The unions involved here represent mostly station agents, the people you see when you're coming in and out of the station, and the train operators, the people who are aboard the train when you're going back and forth. They settled for no pay raise in their last go-around in 2009 and say that they gave up about $100 million in concessions. And so they were really trying to make that up this time and came to the table with a proposal of a 23% increase over 4 years. And the counter from management was pretty much, you know, 1% a year to start.
Hmm.
And all the indications are that they haven't closed the gap very much. And what happened last night was that state mediators appointed by Governor Jerry Brown convinced both sides that they need to call a truce, essentially. And so the unions are coming back to work today, and they've agreed, both sides have agreed, to spend the next month trying to get this thing done.
The contract expired July 1st, and it looks like they have sort of an extension on a contract, on negotiations until the end of August. But Dan Brecky, this has caused major headaches. BART is a major transit system. San Francisco, like Washington, D.C., where I'm from, is famous for its horrible traffic. They need a functioning transit system. You've been one of the riders that's had a great big migraine because of this. What's it been like?
Well, you know, it's been a sort of a tale of two commutes. What's happened with a lot of people, including myself, we've moved our days ahead. We're coming in earlier to avoid the worst of the traffic, although the worst of the traffic keeps moving earlier in the day. So the big choke point coming into the city is something called the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. 17 lanes of traffic merge down to 5 there, and there are metering lights to keep traffic flowing onto the bridge. Those things are going on just after 5 o'clock instead of just after 6 o'clock now. And so there's a huge jam. But if you can get in a carpool, as I've been doing, or get a real early bus or early ferry, you can beat a lot of that. And that's coming into the city. Getting out of the city at the end of the day has been a different story. Very long lines at the ferry terminals, at bus terminals, and the carpool system doesn't work, essentially, in the afternoon. So people have really suffered on that end of the day, and they're exhausted.
Dan, this type of inconvenience is part of the design of a strike. It's designed to put pressure on management to get a deal. We have a couple seconds left. Is it going to work?
We'll see.
We'll
That's
see.
All I can tell you.
Yeah, and you and a lot of other San Franciscans must be dying for it to happen. I mean, you just described a pretty miserable state of affairs.
Well, we don't like discomfort, and there's a lot of public anger and resentment that's come out because of this, and that really suggests there's some deeper issues here that that people are working through. It's not just the transit. It's the lousy economy. It's some other issues.
Unions and management at odds for BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System in San Francisco, just returned back to work after a four-day strike. Dan Brecky, news editor for KQED Public Media in San Francisco. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Over at Facebook, our friends at KQED are asking what the BART strike says about the state of organized labor. Joe writes, labor unions strong-arm their way to outrageous salaries and bennies that did not come close to matching non-labor union workers, crippling companies, government, and cities as a whole. Paul says BART unions are not working for the public's interests, but instead are only trying to get the maximum pay and benefits for a job that doesn't require any more than a GED. You can weigh in on that discussion at facebook.com/KQED or leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/The Takeaway. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, for decades and decades, if you live in Washington, D.C., you've heard the calls for the Washington Redskins NFL team to change their name and change their logo. And that effort has gained some more steam recently. Last month, 10 members of Congress wrote a letter to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell calling the team's name and its mascot a, quote, racial derogatory slur. And they're not the first to say that. The fight against the Redskins' name has been long and arduous for Native Americans who've been actively pushing for it to be changed. But Redskins executives, especially team owner Dan Snyder, are adamant about maintaining the tradition inherent in their name and mascot. They say it would be incredibly difficult to change. Well, we want to talk about that. We want to talk about the effort to change the logo and also about how difficult it would be to change a major franchise team name. Joining us now is Suzanne Schoen Harjo, a Native American activist who was the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit against the team in 1992, which she won, but it was later overturned. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello.
So, Susan, look, Dan Snyder hates to be told what to do. He has a reputation in Washington for defiance against anyone who criticizes the team or his leadership, and certainly on this issue. And the owners of the team say that the use of the Redskins mascot is a tribute to the bravery and majesty of Native American peoples. You say, however, that it's a caricature and a negative one at that.
There's no such thing as a good stereotype. There is only a stereotype. And this is what we have here, is a stereotype. And whether people think it's good or not, it's offensive to the vast majority of Native peoples.
Also on the line with us is Gabe Feldman. He's law professor and director of Tulane University's sports law program. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, Todd.
Gabe, there's been some reporting in the New York Times recently. You were part of it. You were a source for the story over what it would actually take for a franchise as big as the Washington Redskins, one of the richest and biggest in football, if not in the world, to actually change its logo and change its name. One of the arguments from supporters of the name is that it would just cost too much and it would destroy a brand that's way too valuable. Is that true?
Well, there's two pieces to that argument. The second piece, that it would destroy a brand that's valuable, I think there's no question it is a valuable brand. You look at sales of merchandise apparel in the NFL, the Redskins are typically near the top. It's been a name that's been in existence for almost a century now. There's no question there would be some damage to the brand. I think the more difficult question is, what value would they get from the rebrand? There are a fair number of teams who voluntarily change the name of their team. We saw that in Washington when the Bullets changed to the Wizards.
Sure.
We're seeing that in New Orleans from the Hornets to the Pelicans. There can be value in the rebrand. That's an open question that remains to be seen. In terms of how much it will cost, yes, it obviously will cost some money, one, to come up with the new name and the new logo, and two, to remove all traces of the old logo and the old name. But that's a really small number. If you look at the dollars that are floating around the NFL right now, they've recently re-signed television deals that will pay them close to $6 billion a year. They're making almost per team $45 million a year in selling apparel. And let's remember, the apparel sales get split evenly amongst all the different teams. So even if the Redskins logo changes and that diminishes its value, that diminution is shared by all the 32 teams in the NFL. So I think it's a bit unfair and I think unwise for the Redskins to rest their claim on poverty. They really do think that is a drop in the bucket compared to total revenues they bring in from this multi-billion dollar NFL industry.
That's a fascinating aspect of this, that any bite on revenue would be diluted among 32 teams, so that there's really no argument that it would affect the Redskins directly. But what about team loyalty? Another argument here is that fans who follow the Redskins, love the color, a political fight gets involved and they get turned off and they won't come back to the stadium, they won't turn on the TV. What evidence do we have that that's true, or does it just last a short period of time and then they come back?
I think, again, that concern is likely overstated. We don't have a lot of empirical evidence to look at. We've seen in the rebranding of team names that there's an initial boost sometimes and then it plateaus. I really think that if you look at, for example, what happened to the Baltimore Colts when they left the city, replaced by the Baltimore Ravens, people thought you could never replace the tradition and history of the Colts. Well, the Ravens appear to have done that. Again, I don't think this loss of tradition, the hit that the fan base will take, is enough of a reason to keep the Redskins trademark in place. There may be other reasons, but again, I think it's misplaced to rest solely on poverty and the impact it will have on the popularity of the team, because we've seen when the NFL had its lengthy lockout that its fan base is resilient. What NFL fans and Redskins fans would find most offensive is not a change of the name, but if the team does poorly on the field. That's what's going to drive popularity.
Indeed, and there are a lot of people who are offended by the Redskins' performance on the field, that's for sure. Well, Gabe Feldman, before we let you go, you said that there are several good reasons to not change the name. Poverty isn't one of them. But from where you sit in the sports law program, what are the good reasons to leave it alone?
There's several. I'm not sure they're good, but there are some reasons out there, and I think we've touched on some of them. But I do think that the Redskins ownership believe that not only are there good intentions, and this is meant as an honorific term, but that the term is only associated now with the football team and not as a derogatory comment and not as a racist comment. That may not matter, and I think Suzanne would probably argue that their intent doesn't matter. It's the actual impact, and the impact is certainly negative amongst the plaintiffs, the former and current plaintiffs. And that, of course, the tradition, which we've spoken about, where the Redskins have spent a lot of money and a lot of years building up a value in this brand, and that ties into some stubbornness and some greed where Dan Snyder does not like to be told what to do.
Well, let me end with you then, Suzanne Schoen-Harjo, since you are at the center of this fight. You tried in 1992. You succeeded in a way, but not quite, because, of course, the name and logo were never changed. Do you have any indication that you're any closer now in 2013 with a defiant Dan Snyder, who, as we heard, does not like to be told what to do under any circumstances, any closer than you were before?
Well, yes, absolutely. This isn't about what Daniel Snyder can name his team. He can call his team any old racist name he wants, which he's doing now. This is about whether the federal government should subsidize with the exclusive privilege of making money from that racist name. So this is a very different kind of lawsuit. And as to the tradition of the name, the N-word is traditional. There are lots of things that are traditional that have to be consigned to history books and to museums, as this name should be.
I want to point out that we did reach out to the Washington Redskins for comment and to be part of this story. They declined. Gabe Feldman, law professor and director of Tulane University Sports Law Program, and Suzanne Schoen-Harjo, president of the Morningstar Institute in Washington, D.C., former lead plaintiff in Harjo v. Pro Football, Inc. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, elite athletes, they don't last forever. There's a point when many of them say they just have to throw in the towel.
I think over the years, when I've seen players retire, when you ask them about it, they always say you'll know when you're ready. And I think I know when I'm ready. You know, I think I'm ready.
That's David Beckham there, back in May, who at the ripe old age of 38 announced his impending retirement. But some athletes out there think that 38 is just way too young to retire. In fact, many of them think 65 is too young.
I am Roger Gentleholm. I was born on the 21st of May, 1909, on the kitchen table on a third floor tenement in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I am now 100 years old. I have no medication and look forward to the next match.
Roger there is one of many elderly athletes profiled in the film Age of Champions, broadcasting next week on PBS stations across the country. The film chronicles the journey of five elderly competitors who sprint, leap, and swim for gold at the National Senior Olympics. Joining us now is the producer of the film, Keith Aucott, and one of its MVPs, seven-time women's basketball gold medalist and captain of the Celadrin Tigerettes, Mavis Albin.
Thank you very much.
And Keith, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Mavis, let me start with you, if I may, and if I may be so bold, but you're the oldest member of the Celadrin Tigerettes?
I am. It goes from 66 to 76. The youngest is 66.
How long have you been playing?
I've been playing over 20 years.
You didn't start until your 50s.
Well, actually, I did play in high school. But when I graduated, that was way back in 54, I graduated. There was no college teams and no WNBA. So that ended my basketball career. And then I heard about the National Senior Games, and you had to be 55 at that time to play, and I was 55. Since then, they have lowered it to age 50. And I started playing in 1992, and I've been playing ever since.
Keith, let me turn to you. You're not 76. What are you, 25? How old are you?
We were 25 when we started making Age of Champions, my film partner, Christopher Rufo, and I. But we are now 28 years old, and people do kind of, I think they're a little surprised when we show up to host a screening and when we're at a film festival. I think they expect filmmakers that are a little more advanced in age based on the subject matter.
Well, what turned you on to it?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people that are younger in their 20s, teenagers, you know, children, and even people in their 30s and 40s probably have a perception of aging that, you know, as you get older, your active life, sports, competition is beyond you when you're in your retirement years. But when my film partner and I were at a conference for nonprofits in the arts out in California, we met someone who represented the National Senior Games Association. And every 2 years, they put on the Senior Olympics. And, you know, we were just amazed by just the existence of this competition for athletes that are 50 to 100 plus. And just hearing about it shattered what we had in our mind for, you know, what to expect of seniors as they get older when it comes to activity. And then once we got to meet some of the characters like Mavis and the Tigerettes, like Roger Gentleholm, the 100-year-old tennis player, like the 86-year-old pole vaulter that we feature in Age of Champions, we were hooked. We knew we had to tell the story. So we began production back in 2009, and it's been a wonderful journey ever since.
People who are involved in pole vaulting and tennis at the advanced age of 100 and all the training involved have to be feeling pretty good about themselves, I would think.
Absolutely. I mean, people asked, when I set out to make the film, I had some friends and family say, all right, find out what makes them tick. Find out what makes these senior athletes, you know, push themselves so hard, so, you know, advanced in age. And the common denominator is an attitude, as you've referred to, Todd. It's kind of this attitude towards life that's so positive and so forward-thinking and kind of having this idea that their best years are yet to come. And, you know, the other thing that I realized is that they have goals. For instance, Mavis and her team are going for their eighth national gold medal title just in a couple weeks in Cleveland at the national competition. And, you know, to have those goals pushing you day in and day out, I think really keeps senior athletes young.
Yeah. Mavis, you know, 7 gold medals already around your neck, and one thinks, what more goals do you have? I mean, I guess 8 is good, but boy, 7 gold medals.
Well, 7 is good, but we're going for our number 8, and every one of them is very special. One cannot outshine the other, and number 8 would be absolutely fabulous for us to get. But the competition's getting tougher, and the women are getting meaner.
Yeah.
It's getting more physical out there, and we do have a big target on our back, but we're going to give it 100%. We're going to do everything we can to win number 8.
You know, Mavis, I noticed that in the film also. Look, one is tempted to say senior women's basketball to think, oh, it's quaint, how cute, grandma's playing basketball. This is nothing like that.
It is not. It really isn't. We've come out with busted lips and black eyes and broken fingers and bruises all over us. So it is a very physical game, but we don't complain about that because we love the game and we're going to do everything we can to keep ourselves in shape and to be winners because we play to win.
Mavis Albin, what is your point high, your personal one-game high for points?
Oh, when I first started, I think I made about 40 points in one game, but I'm not there anymore. But I do have teammates that make me look good.
40 points in a game is no joke. Keith, this kind of athleticism, forget about the ages, it really is some serious competition. It's no joke. I'm sure you found that.
Well, yeah, absolutely, Todd. And I totally, you know, you've referenced a couple times the kind of the cute factor that a lot of people might have in their mind. And I'll admit, when my film partner and I started the movie, I think subconsciously we had that idea. But at the first shoot, we show up in Cape Cod, and Roger, the tennis player, challenges him and his 94-year-old doubles partner challenged my film partner and I. We're both 25 at the time, and we're both pretty fit, you know, active guys. We're not tennis players, but we decided to accept the challenge, and, you know, we huddled. We said, all right, let's take it easy on him. We just got here. We don't want to hurt Roger's feelings.
And I'll tell you what, before we could change our strategy, they kicked our butts. And, you know, and I was really, it was humbling, it was sad, and Roger really made fun of us a lot the rest of the time we knew him. But the one thing I would say, though, is it really changed our ideas for what to expect, our expectations for of the senior athletes. I think it allowed us to kind of craft a film that was more honest and more respectful to our characters, not as senior athletes, but as athletes first.
Well, I'll tell the both of you, if I may, I have no trouble at all respecting senior athletes. My own dad, a senior citizen, he's a cyclist, riding with 30-year-olds every weekend. The winner of the Mount Evans vertical race in Colorado, the man is an Ironman on the bike. So, Mavis Albin, I have no trouble whatsoever believing that you clear the lanes on the basketball court.
Oh, thank you so much.
Mavis Albin is captain of the Celadrin Tigerettes, one of the stars of Age of Champions, produced by Keith Aucott, who also joins us. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, earlier today, we looked at turmoil in Egypt and asked whether President Morsi's ouster is a military coup or a popular uprising. For Hanan from Fort Lauderdale, it's the latter.
What's happened in Egypt is not a military coup, it's an Egyptian coup. At this point, the Egyptians, 33 million of them, are out in the street. They are very happy and they are rejoicing, and I don't understand how the U.S. is not seeing that and how they are even questioning that.
Many in the U.S. are questioning that, and that debate is going to continue, and we want you to be part of it. Anything you hear on the show, give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, and welcome again to all of our new listeners this week. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.